Welcome to the latest edition of the Peter B. Collins Show, coming to you from San Francisco. Wherever you are and whenever you're listening, I'm glad you found our program. Now, can you share it with like-minded individuals you know? Just pause right now and send an email out to 5 or 10 friends. Tell them to log on to peterbcollins.com. And get the very special brand of independent progressive commentary that you get from your humble host. And I am humbled by the support of many listeners who voluntarily subscribe to this program, linking up to PayPal and sending me as little as $5 a month or more if they can afford it. My thanks right now to Mark Lisgard, Grant Gibson, and John DeVries. You can sign up too. It's voluntary at peterbcollins.com. You're about to hear the latest installment in the Boiling Frogs interview series, co-hosted by the amazing Sibel Edmonds. And today you're going to hear an insider's view of the corporate media. Christina Borgeson worked for many years at CBS News. She talks about the fall of Dan Rather, how his coverage of George W. Bush's spotty military record eventually got him sacked from the anchor chair and separated from CBS News. And Christina tells us working with Dan Rather after he left CBS at HDNet, it appears he's still pretty responsive to Sumner Redstone, who was his boss at Viacom when they owned CBS. And Redstone has nothing to do with HDNet. But you'll hear the sorry story of how Christina prepared an excellent report only to have it blocked from broadcast. And I invite you to visit the new and improved website that Sibel Edmonds has put up at BoilingFrogsPost.com. A lot of original investigative journalism is being published there every week. I hope you'll make it one of your regular stops on the internet. Thanks for listening to this edition of the Peter B. Collins Show. Welcome to Boiling Frogs.
Everybody knows that the days are loaded. Everybody rolls with their fingers crossed. Everybody knows the war is over. Everybody knows the good guys lost. Everybody knows the fight was fixed. The poor stay poor, the rich get rich. That's how it goes.
Everybody knows, but today, NSA's illegal domestic wiretapping, FBI's national security letters, state secrets privilege, TSA's 1 million-plus no-fly list, persecution of government whistleblowers, perpetual wars, rendition and torture. Can you feel the water boiling?
Welcome to the Boiling Frogs with Sibel Edmonds. I'm Peter B. Collins, and today we're joined by journalist and producer Christina Borgeson, and she has a very impressive resume. She's written two books you should be aware of, one called Feet to the Fire, The Media After 9/11, Top Journalists Speak Out, and prior to that she published Into the Buzzsaw, Leading Journalists Expose the Myth of a Free Press. She currently works as a producer for documentaries for the French network Arte, and her most recent episode there was called Bush's Last Crusade. And going back a few years, Borgeson was well-established in television. She worked for CNN's Newsstand show, including investigative programs on unethical business practices in Hollywood. And before that, she worked for the CBS Network's CBS Reports documentary unit, and she worked on a number of important stories there. And she also covered issues like Cuba and Haiti, which is where she grew up. And she has also produced for public television, On Television, a 13-part series for PBS, examines TV's role in American society. And she joins us here on the program today. Christina, thank you for talking with us.
Thanks. I just want to clarify that I produced that show for Arte. The second show was produced for Canal Plus, and that was later.
Okay. So those are two different French networks that you've been working for in recent years?
Yes.
Mm-hmm. So let me just ask you an open-ended question to start. In your opinion, based on your experience as an investigative reporter and producer, what is the state of investigative journalism and enterprise journalism in American media today?
Well, the state of investigative reporting is really not very good, because investigative reporting requires resources, and it requires support, financial support, and time. And certainly the traditional media, the mainstream media, aren't they're, you know, they've pulled way back from that kind of reporting, and are actually going more and more towards entertainment with a little bit of, I mean, they obviously have to cover the wars that we're involved in, and they have to cover the various crises, you know, the money crisis, and the healthcare situation. But, you know, they do that mostly through official source reporting. What you do have is you have independent journalists who are working the internet like crazy, and which is, the internet is great too, because there's been a sort of globalization to reporting that is, you know, helping investigative reporters here who are enterprise reporters gets some really great stories done. However, they don't have the distribution network that they need. So, you know, that's the shortcoming on that side. Because right now in American journalism, they're two distinct and oftentimes clashing cultures. It's the traditional media, and who are, you know, constrained by the interests of their companies and the various agendas that their companies are interested in promoting, and other agendas that they are not interested in, or other information and news that they're not interested in having aired, versus independent report. But they're funded. You know, the journalists there get a regular paycheck, et cetera. And then you have the independent reporters who are not fettered by, you know, administrative agendas or anything, or business agendas, but they don't have the support. Mm-hmm. You know, they don't have the resources.
And when we see, we understand that both newspapers and broadcast have had to cut budgets in the last year or so because of the recession and the huge cutbacks in advertising expenditures. Now, before that, they made rounds of cuts that were designed to prop up their profits and keep the margins for both newspapers and television well above the 30% range. So there were cutbacks prior to the 2008 financial meltdown that were electively pursued by the corporate owners of the media to try to fatten their bottom lines. And then the recession hit, and now they really are scrambling, and they're making some brutal cuts. But as you look at the picture and you see important stories that are not properly resourced, that they will not commit budgets to and allow reporters to spend time on, and yet we get wall-to-wall coverage of the Octomom, of the Balloon Boy, of Michael Jackson's death and funeral, and the disputes over how he died. And so when it comes to pandering to public tastes that they think will produce ratings, there are no limits on, you know, sending choppers and committing all kinds of field crews. But when it comes to critical issues, oh, like the elections of 2000 and 2004, that are fundamental to the credibility of our government and our process, well, the corporate media isn't interested in putting in the time and effort to really get to the bottom of those stories.
Well, look, they're a business, you know, and it, look, as a business, I don't fault them, because they need advertisers. The advertisers fund the news. I mean, it was when news became perceived as a profit center, because there was a time when news was not expected to be a profit center. But when the minute news, you know, was expected to be a profit center, and now, of course, I mean, that's all it's expected to be, you know, all of a sudden the advertiser is king, and the advertiser does not want to hang his products on, you know, dead bodies or, you know, news about major corporations cheating people, or about the CIA assassinating, you know, foreigners on, you know, in the name of the American people. I mean, they want their stuff to be pinned on something that is more entertaining and less controversial. So yeah, they want it pinned on the Octomom and the what is it, the Goslin family and the, you know. So that's been a given for a while, but they are also losing, you know, they're losing their viewership and their readership to the next generation has already mutated into internet news consumers, you know. So that's another problem that they're facing, that they really didn't, you know, they didn't face the internet soon enough. And they sort of they're losing that battle, and which is creating, you know, it's creating an opportunity for people like us.
So that's one major pressure point, the corporate ownership and the effects of that. How about the what I refer to as the source/government pressure? Can you tell us a little bit about how that works and how that has been working, or if you believe that has increased or has changed since September 11th?
Well, one of the things that you didn't mention when you were talking about my resume was a couple years ago, I was hired by HDNet, by Dan Rather Report. I was hired to do a show on the run-up to the Iraq War, and basically the show that I did subsequently for the French, the run-up to the Iraq War, who exactly did what, naming names, okay, not just, oh, the CIA did this or the White House did that, okay, and then looking into who was trying to push us into Iran. And the first thing that really, that it just absolutely floored me was the ignorance among most of these people. Were, you know, Dan was very ignorant on the subject, and, you know, I mean, I have mixed feelings about Dan. I really like him a lot for some reasons, and I really unfortunately lost some respect for other reasons. But you know, this story, for example, nobody, and these are people who had worked for 60 Minutes in 2020, nobody had heard of the Office of Special Plans.
Wow.
Okay, as a matter of fact, the senior producer, when she came on board, she called me up to introduce herself, and the first thing she said to me was, now tell me, how come I've never heard of the Office of Special Plans? And I said, well, I have to tell you, her name was Janice. I said, I have to tell you, Janice. I said, I don't know, but I published a whole book looking into why the press didn't know what it should have known during the run-up to the war. I said, so I don't know what to tell you, you know? And every interview that Dan did, and, you know, he interviewed the people that you know, like Jim Bamford, you know, he interviewed Colonel Wilkerson, he interviewed Pat Lang, and it was like he was being schooled, you know. And as time went on, I finished filming, I was just about to start editing, and one of the things I had to do was call the vice president's office, Cheney's office. I wanted to talk to John Hanna, because he and Wilkerson had worked on vetting Colin Powell's speech to the UN. And so Wilkerson had told me that John Hanna arrived with a clipboard of papers ostensibly backing up what was in the speech. And he said, and this is what Wilkerson said, after 8 hours, we couldn't vet the first page. And so I said, okay, fine. But I had to call John Hanna to, you know, because when you report, you know, somebody is mentioned, you call them and you say, this is what Colonel Wilkerson said about this particular event. Do you have anything to say? And when I called John Hanna's office, his assistant or whatever, secretary, you know, they refused to answer my questions. And so the next, about 2 days later, I'm called into the executive producer's office, and he says to me, "How dare you call the vice president's office?" So I was like, "What? How dare you do that?" You know, and I was like, "Well, I had to confirm." You know, he goes, "How dare you do that? Do you know, who do you think you are?" And then he said, "We have to review this script." He said, "There are a lot of people here who have problems with this script." And by the way, you know, Friday of this the end of this week is your last day here.
Wow.
I was like, "Whoa." And I said, "Well," I said, "listen, I said, if you have problems with my script, I said, we're going to have to sit down and talk about it because, you know, this is my reputation. I've sacrificed quite a bit to maintain my reputation, and, you know, you're not going to tell me that there are problems with this script." And he says, "People say that you took things out of context, and you led your interviews. You led your interviewees on. You put words in their mouth."
Hmm.
And I was like, "Well, those are very serious charges. So we're going to have to talk about it. And everybody who has a problem with this script has to. I want to sit down and talk to them. Yes, we're going to set up a meeting." And so the meeting was never set up. I made several calls. He never set up the meeting. So I did something that I had never done in my career, and it was the equivalent, really, professionally, of taking my pants down in public. You know, I wrote to everybody I interviewed, and I sent them their transcript, and I sent them the script, and I said, "Here is your transcript. Here is your script. Here's what I put in the script. I would like you to tell me if you felt that I coached you during the interview and if you feel that I took what your words out of context in the script." All these people, Paul Pillar, Wilkerson, all these people I had to do that to. And, of course, they all wrote back and said, "No, no, 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 no." So, you know, I had that on file. And so, of course, I knew it had to do, my call to the vice president's office had something to do with it. But I didn't find out until about a year later, Wilkerson told the producer that I was working with on this, my co-producer, Patricia Hartwell, that Sumner Redstone had called and...
He's the chairman of Viacom, the parent of CBS.
Yep.
Mm-hmm.
Had gotten the word to Dan that this show could not go on. That is what Wilkerson said. I asked him who his sources were. He said they were highly placed sources in the government. And I don't, you know, maybe it was Sumner Redstone because, you know, that's who they knew in that. I don't know. I'm just telling you what Wilkerson told me about a year later.
Now, a little background. I thought HDNet was owned outright by Mark Cuban.
It's Mark Cuban.
And so how does Sumner Redstone have any sway over what's going on at HDNet?
Well, he doesn't have any sway over what goes on at HDNet, but understand that, remember that, you know, Dan had this lawsuit going on.
Right.
And with CBS, okay? And I believe CBS is owned by Viacom.
Yes, it is.
Sure.
No, it is.
So, yeah, okay, mm-hmm. It's still owned by Viacom. So, you know, that was the connection.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, I don't even know if this is, I'm just telling you what Colonel Wilkerson told me.
Right.
But I just know that, you know, all of a sudden this whole thing went down literally in a couple of days. The whole thing, I shot this thing. They came to me. They loved the script at first. They said, you know, we're going to make this into a two-hour show. This really hits the nail on the head. This is amazing. And, of course, everything in the script, I mean, has come out times 10
mm-hmm.
since then. But it was just fantastic how that one call to Cheney's office to talk to John Hanna
yeah.
Just did this whole thing in.
Well,
so,
let me ask you a couple of things about Dan Rather. One is I share, and I don't know him nearly as well as you do. I've met him twice and enjoyed my conversations with him. But as a viewer, I have criticism of his work. And, of course, he was on television for decades, so there's a lot to praise and some to criticize. But
right.
I had an opportunity to interview him about a year and a half ago. It was June of 2008. And one of the things I mentioned to him was that he was the last Westerner to interview Saddam Hussein before we invaded in March of 2003.
Mm-hmm.
And I said, Mr. Rather, he told you they didn't have any WMD.
Mm-hmm.
I said, did you believe him? Did you even think for a minute that he might be telling the truth? And do you think about it now? And he said, no. He said, my job as a reporter is just to ask the questions. And I was floored by that because I said, really, he told you what turned out to be the truth. And I understand that a lot of people thought he was bluffing and he had bluffed in the past. And I understand the credibility issues. But I said, did it ever dawn on you for a moment that he could be telling the truth? and Rather didn't want to acknowledge that he had thought about it. And so he just told me, I have no position on that. And I really thought that was just plain odd.
Well, Dan Rather completely understands the game. He totally gets it. He knows what the deal is. Believe me, he does. And you know, he's pushed the envelope a couple of times during his career in a big way, and admirably so. I mean, when he held Poppy Bush's feet to the fire, that was a sight to behold.
He went toe-to-toe with Nixon. I remember
exactly
that news
right.
conference, yeah.
And but he, I think he, as time went on, understood that things were changing, that things were getting tighter, and that the role of any mainstream correspondent who's now making millions a year,
mm-hmm.
which, Dan does not, he comes from a very, very humble background.
Right.
And this is like a guy who has won the lottery career-wise. And I'm not making excuses for him because I think that Dan actually has missed his opportunity at greatness to be a great journalist because he has the resources to stand up.
Mm-hmm. Now, I want to ask the
stories that should be done.
Pardon me. The other question about Rather is the larger issue of the reason that he was ultimately demoted and then fired from CBS, mm-hmm. which was the blowback over his reporting, not on the evening news, but on one of the magazine shows. About Bush's failure to serve in the Texas Air National Guard.
Right.
And Mary Mapes got fired over that. She was quite a producer who I think did an excellent job. And while it's clear that one document didn't hold up to close scrutiny, the story itself was very accurate. And what Rove and his acolytes were able to do was seize on the trivial issue of the font on one document and say, well, this document isn't true, and therefore they tried to make it seem like the whole issue, therefore, was just to be dismissed. When the body of information was overwhelmingly clear, and the witnesses who, Ben Barnes, who knew about the calls that were made and the special back-channel arrangements to get him into the Texas Air National Guard, I mean, all of that was very overwhelming and substantive. Yet they were able to not only dismiss the story just before the election, but they made an example of Dan Rather that lives on in the minds now of every news anchor who wants to take on a president.
Let me tell you, I'll give you my take on this, okay? I think Dan made a huge mistake. One of the problems in network journalism is the correspondent doesn't do the reporting.
Mm-hmm.
Okay? The correspondent gets poop sheets before, he gets a poop sheet saying, okay, here's the story, and then here are the characters, and this character is probably going to say this character is probably going to say that. okay, and so the main characters are X, Y, and Z. Here are the questions for X, Y, and Z that you're going to ask, because he just does the interviews with the main characters, okay? So what Dan should have done was what Peter Arnett did during the Tailwind thing, because remember, April Oliver got in trouble for the Tailwind thing, and they came to, but Arnett was the correspondent, so everybody, you know, since he was the face on TV, people were attacking Arnett, and Arnett stood up and said, hey, wait a second, I'm not the reporter on this, I'm just the face man. You know, everybody knows how it works in network, you know, but Dan, you know, stood up and said, well, you know, I stand behind this and so on. So that was his first mistake. Mary Mapes, let me tell you something. When you are a network reporter, you are paid to get your ducks lined up in a row. So on a big thing like this, Mary Mapes made a big mistake, and she made the big mistake because there was a lot of pressure on the inside to get this story and get this story out. And, you know, the people who were pressuring her, and I know this because a friend of mine who was an investigative reporter for CBS at the time was asked to review before CBS apologized publicly. She was asked to review what Mary Mapes did to find out if CBS should apologize or not. And she said it was clear that this document, the provenance of this document, was not was shaky.
Mm-hmm.
But there was a rush to do this. And yes, you're absolutely right. The story was essentially accurate. But it's high stakes, okay, at network. And Mary Mapes made a mistake. And so, you know, she, you know, a lot of people, you know, some journalists make mistakes and, you know, they get golden parachutes. Other journalists make mistakes, and it's, you know, don't let the door hit you on the butt on the way out, okay?
Yeah.
And Dan, they kind of wanted to let Dan go anyway.
Yes,
but
I agree.
Dan, his response should have been, if this thing is a fake document, I want to know where it came from. I want to talk to the guy who gave this to Mary. He should have made a bigger investigation out of it.
Mm-hmm.
Okay? And then when he got kicked out of CBS, instead of doing this lawsuit where he's spending millions whining about the fact they wouldn't put him on the air as if he's like a correspondent in search of a spotlight, he should take that money and go after that story and get to the bottom of it. That's the Dan Rather that people want to see, not this guy in an expensive lawsuit, you know, because he lost his face time.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, so it was actually an opportunity, I think, for him to show what people always have always admired about him and thought was great about him, you know. And I know working with him, we did this show on, you know, this biography of Fidel Castro with him, and he was extraordinary. You know, he was extraordinary because he has so much experience, and he really understands, you know, power elite. And, I mean, he's a member of the power elite himself, you know, who's been sort of, well, he's been downgraded now. He's working at HDNet. But still, he knows. You know, he hit a tripwire.
Well, given all that we've discussed here, it's still bizarre that Sumner Redstone, who was on the other end of that lawsuit, would make a call to Dan Rather, and that Dan Rather would listen to him about the work you were doing on that special for HDNet. That doesn't
well,
add up
first,
still.
First, let me just be clear that I'm just telling you that this is what Colonel Wilkerson said to me.
Understood.
But if indeed, but there was pressure that came from somewhere, and I think There are two things. One is that Dan was CBS's living logo for a very long time, and he was really haunted by the loss of CBS, okay? And to the point where I'll never forget when the first show on HDNet came out, he was really happy, and he sent around a memo, and he was saying, I want to tell everybody, you know, how much I appreciate the work you've done, and I this and I that. And all the I's were EYE, like the CBS I.
Hmm.
Okay, so it's really like ingrained in CBS was ingrained in his DNA.
Yeah.
You know? And it really was a very, very he was really haunted by that. And then he was trying to get this thing off the ground, and all of a sudden this additional pressure, you know, from this corridor of power was just not something that he wanted to deal with. But you know, you can't turn around and attack somebody's credibility, you know, a reporter. I mean, it's just unethical to turn around and attack a reporter's credibility because you're afraid, you know, and that's the thing. And of all people, I mean, he was talking to the BBC very frankly about the fear in the newsroom. Remember that famous
necklacing
interview?
Yeah, necklacing was the term he used.
Yeah, and excuse me, and you know, all of a sudden, and you want to hear the even more, the deeper irony of this was at the same time that this was happening in his shop, where he and my co-producer and I were being, you know, were being unfairly accused, and our careers were being, you know, our reputations on the line and so on. He was giving an interview to Bill Moyers, you know, about, you know, reporters being, you know, reporters being stifled and so on during the run-up to the war. I mean, it was, I can't believe I just said all this on your show, but...
No, this is why we are doing this show, and it's this is why our listeners love it. Another question, and I just want to take a few seconds and tell you about our experience as national security whistleblowers because of my organization, National Security Whistleblowers Coalition, with 150-plus veteran intelligence officers from the CIA and FBI and DIA, et cetera. We dealt with the media, and because of the organization, I dealt with the mainstream media quite extensively for a period of about 2.5-3 years. And one of the things that we kept witnessing, experiencing, was this amazing double standard. And it was, we really couldn't tell if it was mainly due to the pressure from the editors, pressure from government sources for these reporters, or just the general government pressure, or was it just the reporters making the call. But what they did was with these veteran intelligence officers with impeccable records who had just blown the whistle or reported wrongdoing, some of them even not publicly, they would ask for a tremendous amount of backing. You know, okay, we need to have two more witnesses. Okay, so the whistleblower, and you know how difficult this is.
Yes.
And everybody
in
the organization, like especially during the Bush administration,
yep,
after September 11, trying to get, you know, two, even one witness from inside who's still working with the agency is next to impossible. But we were able to, in some cases, to actually do that. And then you'll bring these witnesses, and the witnesses will say, well, listen, I'm working full-time. I mean, this is my life, but I will give you the statement, but you can't use my name. Next, the reporter would come and say, no, we need at least two more names, by name. We can have additional anonymous, you know, witnesses. And they would make such demands. And we want documents, okay? We want top secret documents on this. Yet, with the government sourced stories that they went, they would not ask for additional sources, witnesses, or
right,
the fact that they needed at least two of those to go on the record with their names, or that they would be provided with top secret or above, you know, classified documents. And we didn't witness this, experience this once or twice or three times. I'm talking about tens of times of this experience. And then we have had our hypothesis there, you know, the theories. You know, it's due to these editors, the government pressure. Tell us a little bit of your experience and how usual or unusual this is, usual it is.
Well, it's very common, and I'll tell you why. They are what I call the black holes of reporting. Okay, one of the black holes of reporting is any kind of malfeasance, particularly, malfeasance on the part of, CIA, FBI, malfeasance on the part of high-level officials in the White House. I mean, a whistleblower, they are terrified of whistleblowers. Because if you use the whistleblower as a source and you tell this story, okay, that means that you know that there's going to be a response from the power that be that you have just outed, doing something criminal or wrong, so they live in a landscape littered with triggers, okay. I mean, I can tell you when I worked for CNN, sometimes the stories aren't even that big a deal. I remember I went to my boss and I said, let's do a story on the vertical integration of the entertainment industry, because it's really just a few companies determining what you carry around in your brain when you watch TV. And she goes, oh, Christina, we can't do that story. It was too controversial. Hmm. You would upset very powerful people in the entertainment industry, and this was when I was working for CNN Newsstand. It's part of doing business in that arena. There are stories that you just don't tell. I mean, look at the Israeli-Palestinian issue. Look at anything that has to do with the Israeli lobby.
Absolutely.
Those are the deepest, darkest black holes. Look at our relationship or the Bush's relationship with the Saudis. When George Bush Jr. There's a whole landscape of things where things are really being done, very serious things are being done, and that result in loss of life, that result in loss of our civil liberties, that result in all kinds of very dire, that have all kinds of very dire results that we don't hear about. Everybody knows where the limit is. It's almost instinctual. When one of these stories hits their desk, they I don't know anything about the CIA, I can't do that story. They don't want to do those stories. Or, oh, no, I don't want to, They just won't touch them because they know what the potential for blowing up their career is. And it's such a competitive environment. There are 20 people who want your job, So if you're going to cause trouble by doing stories on the power elite, exposing what the power elite is up to or what your government's deep, dark institutions are up to, forget it. You're out.
Most definitely. That brings me to another question I have, which is related to this, and that is the incestuous relationship that exists between reporters and their sources. And, one recent example of this was with Walter Pincus, who was covering the recent Blackwater lawsuit in court. And mm-hmm. and lo and behold, his son has been representing Blackwater in court.
Oh, my God.
See, and you have seen people within the alternative media, I believe Jeremy Scahill exposed this, and it basically went all over Twitter. But you haven't heard anything from the mainstream media because it is considered some kind of a norm. Another example is a story I'm working on right now that one of the characters that I'm focusing on is the CIA guy. Maybe you have heard of his name, Milt Bearden?
Sure.
Okay. Well, and this goes back to his role in 1980s as the CIA station chief in Pakistan and
yep.
later in Afghanistan. And of course, the work they did there with Mujahideen and of course, the book by Golden and Fitzgerald covers a lot of that. But as I started researching, I saw that Mel Bearden, not only he has been quoted as source by New York Times about at least a billion times, he actually was the co-author of a book with James Risen, who's been reporting on CIA-related issues, and Milt Bearden has been one of his reliable sources, but they went into business together, and they published a book together.
None of this surprises you, right? I mean, you realize...
Of course not me.
The New York Times, the two power centers in terms of media, for print, obviously, are the New York Times and the Washington Post. And, you know, Feet to the Fire, one of the things that, you know, I learned from doing Feet to the Fire is that you can't hit a critical mass of, you know, with your reporting. In other words, you know, you can't have an impact with your reporting unless you can have millions of people in the flyover states who read your paper. But you will not hit critical mass unless the leaders and the power elite in Washington and New York are reading your reporting. Okay? That's why Knight Ridder, when they did their run-up mm-hmm. to the war, their reporting on the run-up to the war, you know, got no traction. And they got it right. Okay? The Washington Post and the New York Times have certain ironclad agendas. Okay? Nobody talks about them, okay? But it's very, very clear what they are to people who, and boy, am I getting into deep water here. But, you know, I'll just say this.
I've got a life vest for you, Christina.
Okay, you go ahead and tell me. You go ahead and say it. But, you know, the bottom line is they were both pro-war.
Yep.
Okay. Our Middle Eastern foreign policy, they want to drive it in a very pro-Israel direction.
Yes.
Most definitely.
And the reporting is going to skew in that way, whether it's this story's on page 1 and this story's on page 17 and all the editorials are going to say X. Okay? I mean, it's very, very clear to the point where, I mean, you would think after the Judith Miller thing, I mean, there have been other incidents, but after the Judith Miller thing, that people might say, well, maybe we should, you know, maybe this is not so much the paper of record when it comes to at least covering certain iron portfolio issues.
Well, and Christina, I wanted to add one other example here because we've seen a very unhealthy collusion between the administration in Washington and major media outlets. And it surfaced in the embedding of reporters with troops, and that certainly affected the reporting. It also surfaced to the credit of the New York Times. They exposed the way Rumsfeld handpicked the retired generals who were then placed on television networks to deliver talking points about the progress of the war in Iraq. And that is an issue that has yet to be covered by the electronic media. They are not self-critical, and they've just kind of brushed off the Times front page story about that. But there's one other that I wanted to bring to your attention. Mark Klein is the former AT&T technician here in San Francisco who exposed the domestic wiretapping program, what's euphemistically referred to as warrantless wiretapping.
Yes.
I call that illegal wiretapping because the Fourth Amendment is pretty clear about that, and so is the FISA statute. At any rate, Mark Klein was burned by a number of reporters, both at the New York Times and at the Los Angeles Times.
Mm-hmm.
And the L.A. Times took advantage of Klein because they said, well, show us what you've got. Give us your information. And he was a bit naive, and he did. And instead of putting it in the newspaper and writing a story quoting Mark Klein and showing the documents he had that proved that this massive diversion of our communications was taking place, they took it to John Negroponte, who was at the time the so-called intelligence czar. And they never published a word about Mark Klein and the important revelations that, he made about this extensive wiretapping program. Instead, they took it to the government and put Mark Klein at great risk. And they seemed oblivious to that. They were more interested in currying favor with the intelligence czar than they were in reporting a critical story and a huge violation of our Fourth Amendment rights.
Well, I mean, again, I can't say it in any stronger terms. There are certain bottom line agendas that are pushed through the reporting, and you know, they don't change. They don't change from administration to administration. And as a matter of fact, even the, I mean, look at Obama right now, okay?
Mm-hmm.
I mean, Obama, you know, he reinstated the Patriot Act. You know, he's continuing the war in Afghanistan. So,
well, and the wiretapping continues unabated. There has been no change in that program.
There has been no change anywhere. As far as I know.
Exactly. On these issues, there has been no change. I mean, this is a long-term agenda, and we're deep into it. And that's what, you know, you're not going to get the reporting that you really need from these mainstream outlets that are... Their arms, the reporting arms, basically communications arms for the power elite. You know, I don't know how else to put it, but they're gonna tell the stories the way, you know, the White House wants them to tell the story, the way you know, the owners of the papers who are supportive of certain things want them to tell the story. And it's not as if the owners of the paper tell that to the reporter directly. It filters down. I mean, Fox, of course, is the most naked example of all. That's the Republican Party's, you know, propaganda arm. I mean, Charlie Reina said, you know, he's the guy who talked about the memo that, mm-hmm. that appears on the reporters' computer screens every day, telling them how to cover these stories. You know, how to cover the Iraq War, how to cover demonstrations against the war. You know, so it's all rigged. It's all rigged. It's all fixed. I mean, that to me, having been reared in Haiti, where they, you know, they just shoot the journalists if they don't like what they're reporting. But here, it's very sophisticated, and it's breathtaking. It's awesome. It really is. It's really awesome. And as a result, we have a population that lives in Wonderland, literally in Wonderland, because they get all this reporting. It has no history, no context. It's not really. It just kind of floats out there, and it comes at them in little pieces and little blips and blurbs, and it gives them impressions. And you know, that's the information environment,
Christina,
and it's very bizarre.
No, that's fully agreed. The other side, the new wave, the so-called online alternative news sites. Let's look at those channels, whether on the right or in the left of the political spectrum, and I want to ask for your take on how you assess them, because from what we have been discussing with producers, journalists like yourself, is the absence of a place where the real investigative journalists who've been just tired, disgusted with the mainstream media, to go to, because many see the alternative either way too partisan, which is really prevalent, or not really serious investigative reporting. And a lot of these sites, they put news in their title, but they recycle the mainstream media news. I mean, they're constantly playing Keith Olbermann's tape and Rachel Maddow's tape, and they take things from New York Times and Washington Post, give different title. So how do you assess the current state of the online so-called alternative news outlets?
Well, it's caveat emptor, right? It's a little crazy, but what has to happen, and I think that it's starting, it will hopefully shake out this way, where the reliable sources do sort of come through the noise. I know what sources, I like to go to on a regular basis, and if you go to different sources and you see the same information from diverse sources, chances are that the information is pretty good. I also like as much as possible to get information from sources that are actually from the country where whatever is happening. You know, it's always nice that Asia Times Online, for example, sometimes their stuff is really fantastic.
I do agree. I have them under my favorite.
Oh my God! I mean, today, what's his name? Mubayed. He did a background, sort of a history and context view of that Baghdad blast that was just fantastic. And I just thought to myself, my God, if people were watching TV or reading a newspaper that had this assessment, they'd really start to understand how crazy, untenable this situation is. With us in the middle, and I don't, but what can you do? It's wonder. I literally call it Wonderland News. When I watch CNN, I'm just, and John Klein, the president of CNN, this is not a hard news guy. I mean, this is a guy who actually, he should have gone to Hollywood and done, movies of the week. He was very good at, he did these feature documentaries on, not hardcore news stuff, so it's really, it's very, very distressing to me. But I think what you have to do is everybody in the, who's looking for the news? Well, I mean, we're professionals, right? So we know what the good sources are. The thing is to sort of try and bring these sources out to the rest of the public, and that's the big trick that needs to be turned. But I'm peddling as fast as I can to do that.
Christina,
that's
I want
the jobs for me.
I want to turn to what's missing from our media, and you used two terms a moment ago that I think are pretty much lost in the media world in the United States these days, history and context. And I know you're quite familiar with Project Censored, which has operated near me at Sonoma State University. Peter Phillips is the current director of the program. And their new top 25 censored stories from the past year just have been published. And I wanted to pick one just as an example here, because I think this will stun people as it did me. We have seen a lot of footage and some reports on the Somali pirates and the ships that they have heisted, held for ransom, that sort of thing. And there was the story earlier this year where President Obama authorized an American sniper, a Navy sharpshooter, to take out one of the pirates, and he was successful, and it had a momentary buzz. But
right.
In all the reporting about Somali pirates, and now they've become a laugh line on comedy shows, no one has reported in the mainstream media in this country what Al Jazeera and the Huffington Post have reported, which is that there's a history here. And the Somali pirates are doing this because for years, other nations have been poaching their fish and dumping toxic waste in Somali waters.
Exactly. Exactly.
And there is no central government, there is no functioning Somali Navy to try to protect their interests. Now, I am not for a moment supporting piracy or suggesting that what they're doing is net-net a good thing. But our media has not given us any history or context about why on earth these Somali pirates would go out in little boats and try to take over big ones.
And, on this particular story, it is surprising, and I'll tell you why. Because there's no, the U.S. has no particular dog in this fight.
Right.
Okay. this is sort of a straight up, as you said, you know, the poaching by, I think, a lot of Japanese and, you know, other fishing, international fishing boats, and the toxic waste dumping. I don't know. And the only thing that I can say to you is that, oh, God, this is such a terrible thing to say, but it's like, oh, well, you know, these third, they're not even third world, they're like fourth world people. You know, of course you can imagine them being, you know, poor and so desperate and so, you know, primal that they get on these boats and desperate, you know, they get on these boats and do, you know, they just look no further. And then when this part of the story came through, you know, I'm sure it's on somebody's radar. They, oh, well, we've already done the Smalley Pirate thing. I mean, it's literally, it's that, that's one of the things that would shock you, is, and it is a big problem. And even, you know, among some of the people that I interviewed, for Feet to the Fire, and I interviewed big people, you know, I mean, they're, you know, Helen Thomas you know, Ted Koppel and, you know, Peter Arnett and Bamford and Krugman and all these people, you know, there are other people in there working in major jobs. I won't name names because I don't think it's politics. They were very kind to grant me interviews and tell me important things. But there is provincialism, you know. There's a lot of provincialism. These are people who, when they go and they go to foreign countries, the attitude is not so much, you know, let me take all this in and let me just, you know, filter it through. And they get off the plane and they say, boy, this is not like New York. And so the minute you walk in with that attitude, then your whole story, your whole everything is, your whole orientation is about how it's different from, you know, your civilized corner of the world, as opposed to, oh, here's a place, here's a situation, this is what is here. You know, and it really is important to just make yourself, I mean, it would be best if our journalists could speak the languages of the countries that they cover, you know, because then you know, when you speak a language, you really get into the headspace, the mentality of a culture.
That seems unnecessary because, you know, the press releases are all in English.
Yeah, but you know, when you go to a foreign country, and I mean, I was reared in Haiti. My first language is Creole, and you know, I lived there for almost my entire childhood up to the age of 17, with the exception of 3 years that we spent in Ohio when I was from 14 to 16. And you know, I can't tell you how ridiculous some of the press coverage of Haiti was.
Yeah.
You know, particularly about, you know, how the U.S. just looked down on Papa Doc because he was such a bloody dictator. I mean, the U.S. held hands very tightly with Papa Doc, and I happen to know this from a firsthand basis because my father was a military attaché down there, and he had his office right next to Duvalier, and the two of them worked together. So, you know, as I say, it's Wonderland.
Christina, for some reason, a Joni Mitchell song has been rolling around in my head. It's Big Yellow Taxi, and one of the lines in there is, they took all the trees and put them in a tree museum. They charge the people a dollar and a half just to see them.
See them.
Well, now there's a news museum called Newseum, funded by the fine folks at USA Today, which gave me pause right to start with. But I'm curious, do you think that fearless investigative journalism will be relegated to an exhibit at the Newseum, and it's something that is part of our past?
No. No, because it's going on right now. I mean, there are a lot of really great people. I mean, look at Sabell. You know, there are a lot of fantastic, really, really smart people. As a matter of fact, the crisis has brought these people into relief. Every time I listen to Amy Goodman, you know, on Democracy Now! And the stories that she does, I'm like, oh, my God, thank God for Amy Goodman. Jeremy Scahill and his work, you know, mm-hmm. there are a lot of people. Jim Bamford,
yeah,
you know, I mean, there are a lot of people, mavericks, really smart people who are doing amazing stuff. And, you know, Juan Cole, who does his
University of Michigan.
His blogging on the Middle East. I mean, there's some fabulous, fabulous people out there. But, you know, the challenge is to get them to hit the 100th monkey phase, as they say. You know, the challenge is to get them to hit critical mass. And that is one of the things that I'm actually trying to figure out how to do. And because I think it's really, really important. And I think there's one thing to keep in mind, and that is that this audience, you know, the next generation of news consumers, they're a mutation from us. You know, they want to get their news in pictures, and they want to get it on a screen and not a TV screen.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, all these mavericks, all of, you know, you, me, and Bamford and Juan Cole and, you know, Scahill and, you know, Russ Baker, Craig Unger, all these people, you know, we have to keep that sharply in mind.
Christina Borgeson, thank you for spending time with us, and thank you for being so candid. I think people will really appreciate it.
Most definitely. Many thanks, Christina.
I don't know if everybody will, but you're welcome.
That's Sumner Redstone on line 4.
Joining us. We'll be back soon with more Boiling Frogs interviews.